coming up on this special edition of The Green from Delaware Public Media. We continue our series of 2024 candidate conversations with interviews from the race for U.S. Senate. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Our look at the U.S. Senate campaign focuses on two of the three candidates, Republican Eric Hansen and the Independent Party of Delaware's Michael Katz. Plus, our Races to Watch series puts the spotlight on the Democratic primary for mayor of Wilmington. That's all next on this special edition of The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this special edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. As part of our 2024 election coverage, Delaware Public Media is offering a series of candidate conversations. We reached out to all candidates filed in the races for U.S. House and U.S. Senate, as well as governor, lieutenant governor, and insurance commissioner, and invited them to sit down with us. Candidates in each race are being asked about the same set of topics to allow you to get to know them and compare them. The interviews you hear on The Green are edited for time. Full conversations are online at DelawarePublic.org. The race for U.S. Senate features three candidates seeking to replace Democrat Tom Carper, who is retiring after four terms and 24 years in the Senate. Today we focus on two candidates, Republican Eric Hansen and the Independent Party of Delaware's Dr. Michael Katz. We start with Hansen, a business executive making his first run for political office. So you talked a little bit about your experience at Walmart and how that's kind of influenced you and your decision to come into the campaign. Are there some other things maybe voters should know about your qualifications for the job?
Yeah. So what I would say is, again, proud non-politician. And I think part of the problem with politics right now are the politicians. And the incentive for politicians are to keep getting reelected and not necessarily to elect the people or to represent the people that elected them. So not being a politician, not being establishment, being a business person who really focuses on the results rather than on the reelection, I think is really important. I have said publicly, and I'm on the record saying this, I will run for one term. And the reason I'm saying I'll run for one term, and then only if the majority of Delawareans think I did a great job in the first term would I even consider running for two and no more than two, is because it will free me to do the things that most politicians can't do. To do the things that are right for the electorate and the people and not right for getting them reelected. So that really frees me in a way that isn't possible elsewhere.
So I want to talk about some issues. Obviously, voters have consistently listed the economy as a top issue, if not the top issue. The Biden administration does tout low unemployment, strong job numbers recently, along with some other positive economic indicators as signs the country is headed in the right direction. But inflation, higher prices for many people on everyday goods leave many still struggling. What would you support Congress doing to promote economic growth?
Yeah, I think that people really struggle with the cost of living right now. So inflation is high, interest rates are high, housing is high, rental costs, insurance, it goes on and on. And people are not seeing the relief that the press is talking about. You go to the grocery store, you go to the gas pump, you're still feeling the pinch, and a lot of people really struggling. I think the right thing to do is twofold. One is we have to give a tax break to working families that are still struggling with inflation and high cost of living. And number two is we have to get government spending under control. We waste likely $1 trillion or more in the federal government. And if we take that money and we get rid of the wasteful, inefficient spending and spend it on the programs that really do benefit the people, then we stimulate the economy. Everyone has more money in their pocket. It does great things for the government. So it's really about spending correctly and reducing the size of the government to the government that is going to serve the people the best, not the government that's spending the most.
You mentioned tax breaks for those who are hurting the most. When you think about that, what type of bracket are you talking about? I guess what kind of like salary range are you talking about? What are people making that you feel need that tax break?
Yeah, so it's really everyone who's not high income is really struggling right now.
Is there
now
a number you put on high income? Like what do you consider high income?
So I think anyone who's making as a family more than, say, $150,000 a year is that's roughly twice the household or three times the average household income. So those people are probably doing okay. Mm-hmm. It's and the ultra wealthy are doing just fine in today's economy. Mm-hmm. It's the blue collar workers mm-hmm. that are struggling. It's the average families that are struggling. It's the single moms that are struggling. Those mm-hmm. are the folks that we really have to fix.
Let's move on to immigration. There was a bipartisan border reform bill ready to go before many Republicans backed away at the behest of former President Donald Trump. Would you support that bill if elected?
Yeah, the border is a huge issue. And what I think needs to happen at the border is twofold. One is we have to have the asylum reform because right now the asylum rules just allow anyone claiming asylum to come in. They come into the country. They wait a long time for a trial. And then essentially they're here forever. Those rules do have to get reformed. At the same time, we do have to make sure that legal immigration is promoted. Make sure that we have as much legal immigration as is appropriate so we get good key skilled workers in the country and that we get the jobs that we aren't able to fill with American workers filled with legal immigration. But we have to stop and end the illegal immigration. It's the illegal immigration that's the real problem. So the asylum rules help that. Enforcing the law helps that. And then unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be a good way to stop the influx. So continuing to work on things like fences and borders and walls might be necessary, unfortunately.
But is the fact that there was a bipartisan bill there that did not move forward, is that disappointing to you that there was, even if it wasn't a perfect bill?
Yes.
Should a bill like that move forward just to start taking steps to address some of the things that you're talking about?
Yeah. So one of the things that we do in the government too often is we let perfection get in the way of good or in the way of positive forward momentum. So yes, even if it's not perfect, we need to move the ball ahead and we need to move towards reforms and towards border reforms that help us get to where we need to be. And we can't think about the border as trying to score political points. We just have to solve the problem.
Moving on to another issue, following the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe v. Wade, the issue of abortion has been left to the states,
yes.
Creating kind of a patchwork of approaches across the country and also leaving questions about other related reproductive issues like IVF. Should Congress step in some way? And if so, how?
So the Dobbs decision pushed abortion back to the states. Mm-hmm. And Delaware has been pretty clear on where they stand with respect to abortion. And it would be inappropriate for me as the federal elected official in the Senate to override and defy the will of the people here and to override Delaware law. So I will not vote for a federal abortion ban. Ultimately, it's the decision of the state and the people in the state, and they have made their decision very clear. The other piece of your question was about IVF.
Mm-hmm.
I think IVF is fantastic. I fully support IVF because there's lots of couples struggling to have children right now, and IVF is a path to getting children for those folks. So 100% support of IVF.
Okay. So in the wake of that Roe decision and some others recently by the Supreme Court, President Biden is now suggesting some effort to reform the Supreme Court, whether it be through an ethics code, term limits, something you just talked about for yourself, you would impose upon yourself. Would you support any of those type of Supreme Court reforms?
Yeah. It's late in the game for us to do some of these reforms. But yes, it's time for us to step back and think about what reforms for the Supreme Court might be necessary. And the reason why is that we as a nation have lost some trust in the Supreme Court, and we want to bring that back. It's to the benefit of the country, but the Supreme Court, that we think about what some of those reforms could be.
Do you have any thoughts on those specifically, ethics code or term limits?
So I think the ethics code is a great one because right now it's they're self-managing
right.
their ethics code. And so I think having a third party think about that makes sense. I think having some term limits makes sense, and having an age limit probably makes sense as well. We've seen the impact of having ages that creep up and impact cognitive skills. We don't want that in any branch of the government.
So let's talk a little bit about some foreign policy issues. We'll start with Israel and Gaza. President Biden has been seeking a ceasefire in Gaza for some time to no avail so far. Your thoughts on how the U.S. should be approaching this conflict as it continues to go on and the death toll continues to rise and the hostages taken by Hamas remain still in as hostages?
Right. So first, we have to say that Israel is our strongest ally in the Middle East. And so Israel defending itself against Hamas's attack was, I think, entirely appropriate. Hamas's attack was brutal and inappropriate. We do need to try our best, and I support Israel in eradicating Hamas. I feel terrible for the Palestinians caught between Hamas and Israel, and I support humanitarian aid for the Palestinians. But we all have to recognize the fact that Hamas and the Hezbollah organization are essentially proxy war puppets for the Iranian government. And so Iran is not paying the price, nor are we holding them accountable fully for the proxy war that they're waging on their behalf through Lebanon and through the Gaza Strip against Israel. We need to hold Iran accountable for what they're doing.
The other major foreign policy issue is the war in Ukraine. That continues. Where do you stand on continuing support to Ukraine as it continues to fend off a Russian invasion that is now over 2.5 years old?
Yes, Putin's a bully. And unless you push back on bullies, their bullying will continue. So I think keeping Russia in check is the right thing to do. And us keeping Russia from expanding into Ukraine further or into more of Europe is exactly the right thing to do. I think we'll find ourselves on the wrong end of history if we don't. That said, we have done more than our fair share to support Ukraine. And it's really time that NATO steps up and carries a much heavier portion of that burden.
To an issue that is both domestic and kind of global, climate change. Your thoughts on what the federal government and specifically Congress's role should be in trying to blunt the impact of climate change?
So I think the first thing we need to recognize is that no matter what the U.S. does, the China and India coal-fired power plants and their expansion of the use of coal is going to negate anything that we do in the U.S. So I'm not saying we should stop here in the U.S., but the bigger issue is India and China coal. So the first thing that we need to do is start to tariff items that are produced in India, China that are very dependent upon energy. So, for example, glass and steel. If those tariffs are put in place, it provides an incentive for China and India to move away from dirty energy to cleaner energy. That solves a world problem with dirty, polluting climate issues. And then in the U.S., I'm not saying we should stop, but what we should do is probably lean much heavier on innovation than regulation. So mandates don't make sense to me, EV mandate as an example. Okay. But innovation is a great thing. Innovation gave us 80 to 200 years of natural gas through horizontal drilling. Mm. That's fantastic. It allows us to be more energy independent. In fact, you know, maybe an energy exporter. Those are the great kinds of innovation that help us as a nation. And because of the innovation in natural gas, we've been able to switch over from coal to natural gas-fired plants and reduce greenhouse gases in our country by 30%. Fantastic. Exactly the kind of path we should take. Solar is another great one. Right now, China really owns solar. It would be great if U.S. innovation could take back some of that solar energy production to the U.S.
So you're saying perhaps in those type of areas, let's say solar, for instance, you don't want mandates, but you would prefer incentivizing, moving maybe the market along, or how would you push those type of innovations in the direction you want them to go?
Right. It's market-based solutions in combination with incentives.
Okay.
So EV mandate is a perfect example. Instead of telling people you have to buy an EV, even if you can't afford it, even if the charging infrastructure isn't there, even if the auto dealers are reacting negatively, even if farmers could never afford to switch over, small farmers especially, switch over to EV farm equipment, a much better choice would be to say, as we have in the past, here's an incentive, and then the market takes over, and then people are more satisfied, and the market moves as it should. So incentives, in my mind, are much better than mandates.
Okay. I do want to ask a very Senate-centric question, and that has to do with the filibuster. There's been a lot of discussion over recent years about doing away with the filibuster. Would you support getting rid of the filibuster, and why or why not?
So I'm not in favor of getting rid of the filibuster. I love the filibuster removal in the sense that it moves the government ahead and we get more results out of the government. But the problem isn't so much because of the filibuster we're not getting results. The filibuster is also keeping us from making bad decisions. So part of the thing that the government was set up to do was prevent bad decisions from being made. The fundamental problem right now is we've got too much polarization in the government right now between the right and the left, and we don't have people willing to work together to get collaboration and get results. So the fundamental problem is collaboration. It's not the filibuster.
So building on that a little bit, this is a time that, does seem to be a stronger distrust of government and calls for more transparency and accountability at all levels of government. If elected, what role do you feel you could play personally in delivering greater transparency and accountability and building trust in government through working in Congress?
Yeah. So one of the things is every single agency should be more transparent in what they're doing and the data they're collecting and making sure that there is full transparency. The other thing I think is important is for the legislature to be more transparent as well. Things like term limits I just talked about helps with that. But another thing, for example, that I could propose and I think would be a great idea is that all senators, all congressmen have to put all of their assets and all of their net worth into blind trusts so that they no longer manage their assets and there's no incentive for them to manipulate or to vote in a way that benefits them personally.
Building on that, I mean, we've heard a lot of rhetoric, and you talked earlier about polarization, and a lot of that rhetoric seems to be heated. And even in the wake of the assassination attempt on former President Trump, there was this initial talk about, okay, let's cool the temperature down. It doesn't seem like that has really stuck very much. Do you feel that there's a real problem there, that we are at some kind of tipping point in terms of where our democracy stands and how it's going to move forward, and can it move forward in a productive way?
We are at a tipping point. I've traveled all across Delaware, and I've talked to tens of thousands of people at this point, all across the political spectrum, and everyone largely agrees that we've got major problems we need to solve, and the government's not solving them. So we've got to get to the point where we get to solutions. And part of the problem, I talked before about this, is the politicians. And doing things like term limits provides the incentive so we get to the solutions. But ultimately, it's about collaboration. And right now, we don't have collaboration. We have political polarization, and we have the far left and the far right who aren't talking to each other, and mainstream America is getting left behind. We have to have collaboration. We have to have people who are willing to work together. And as a Republican, reasonable Republican senator from a blue state, that gives me the power to be a collaborator in the way that lots of other folks can't be. Someone who says, I'm going to work as a one-term senator, gives me the power to work and to collaborate in a way that lots of other people can't. Being a non-establishment, non-politician gives me the power to work across the aisle in a way that people can't. It's about getting results that impact everyone, no matter what your political affinity.
I want to finish by asking you if there's an issue we haven't discussed that you feel is not getting the attention it deserves in this election cycle, and how you would address it if elected.
We've got a couple issues I really want to tackle.
Sure.
One is the economy and debt and deficit that are out of control. The fact that we don't have balanced budgets at the federal level is absurd. The fact that even once we start spending, we still have continuing resolutions and supplemental spending that spend beyond our means. That's just not appropriate. So the economy and the budget and the debt and deficit have to be fixed. At the same time, we do have to protect things like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, these entitlement programs, but we just have to reform them so that we're spending wisely in those entitlements. The other thing we have to fix is crime. Violent crime in Delaware is, last year, highest rate in increase in violent crime in the country. We have to tackle violent crime. And the way to do that is, if we can't get state prosecution, we'll bring in federal prosecutors to prosecute violent criminals in Delaware. And then the last thing is education. Education across the country is not where it needs to be, but in Delaware, especially bad. And what we've shown is, historically, spending more is not the solution. We can't throw more money at the problem and expect the same solution. We have to do things differently. So education is the last piece I think is critically important to fix.
That's Republican candidate for U.S. Senate Eric Hansen. Our full conversation with him is available at DelawarePublic.org. Up next, our candidate conversation with Dr. Michael Katz, the Independent Party of Delaware's candidate for U.S. Senate. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to a special edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. And I'm Tom Byrne. We continue our candidate conversations with more from the race for U.S. Senate, where we now hear from the Independent Party of Delaware's candidate, Dr. Michael Katz. Katz previously served one term in the Delaware State Senate as a Democrat, winning the North Wilmington 4th District seat in 2008, then losing it to Republican Greg Lavelle in 2012. A reminder, the candidate conversations you hear on The Green are edited for time. Full conversations are online at DelawarePublic.org. Tell us a little bit about your background and qualifications for the job. Perhaps something that voters may not be able to glean from like your campaign website or you know just kind of looking up Dr. Mike Katz.
Sure. Well, just going back quite a few years, I grew up in a small town in Connecticut in a working class family. My dad was a small business person, was not college educated. My mom was the editor of a small town newspaper. I am a pediatric critical care anesthesiologist, a business owner, also a former Delaware state senator. My wife and I came to Delaware. I was at Boston Children's Hospital and recruited to AI DuPont Hospital for Children. And we feel so fortunate that we found our way to Delaware and were able to have and raise our family here. We have three grown kids who are all born in Delaware. And my wife and I have been married for 37 years.
So let's talk about some issues, and we'll start with immigration. You know, there was a bipartisan border reform bill ready to go before many Republicans backed away at the behest of former President Trump. Curious if that is a bill that you would support if elected?
Well, first of all, the way I approach legislation, most legislation and legislators at the state level and at the federal level are, I call, downstreamers. They're basically very reactionary and dealing with symptoms of problems, and immigration is a major issue for us. So instead of dealing with the symptoms, putting a Band-Aid on a problem, I like to look at sort of the upstream causative root problems that we're dealing with. Immigration is an extremely important issue for our country. It's the foundation of our country. Most of us in this country are here because of immigration, and we need to make sure that immigration is legal, safe, and secure. It's a national security issue to make sure that we abide by the laws of our country and that people come through our borders. We do it safely, legally. We're making sure that we are addressing the specific needs of our country. And also, we want to make sure that we are careful of issues. And as a physician, I'm concerned about, what diseases are coming across the border, making sure that we're not reintroducing diseases that we've eradicated in our country, and also public safety issues, making sure that our communities are safe. So without, diving into specifics of a current piece of legislation, I like to go upstream and look at the problem, what our goals, objectives are about legal, safe, and secure immigration, and make sure that we fine-tune and optimize the laws of our country to make sure that we have safe communities and we have a law-abiding society.
Following the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe v. Wade, the issue of abortion has been left to the states, creating kind of a patchwork of approaches throughout the country and leaving questions about other related reproductive issues like IVF. Do you believe Congress should step in some way? And if so, how?
Well, I believe in separation of power. We have three branches of government. We have the legislative, the executive, and the judicial. My concern, first of all, is that the politicization of those branches of government and the sort of the bleeding together of the roles of those government roles of government. So I believe that we need to make sure that we are not overstepping the bounds and, as legislators, unduly influencing the courts. The courts have their role, they have their expertise, and we need to make sure that we have separation of the powers. With respect to abortion specifically, Supreme Court has stated that and determined that the determination of abortion and the ability to have an abortion is under the rule of the states. Delaware does have legal abortion. As a physician, I believe that every patient, and we are all patients, every patient has specific health needs that are specifically unique. And ultimately, every health decision should be made between the patient and their physician.
Building on the idea of the Supreme Court and its decision-making process, in the wake of that Roe decision and some others recently by the court, President Biden has suggested some efforts to reform the court, specifically ethics rules, perhaps term limits. Would you support any of those type of measures to change the way the Supreme Court currently operates?
Well, this is an example of how I'm very concerned that the Supreme Court has been politicized. Mm-hmm. And so we need to make sure that it never hurts to take a look at our Constitution, how it's structured. It's, well, you know, it's almost 250 years old. It's a beautiful document. It always amazes me the more I study it, how brilliant the people and our founders were to create that document and how they were able to do it so long ago. And, you know, I think about it, probably one of the reasons why they were able to do it is because they sat down for quite a bit, you know, weeks and weeks together and discussed. And that's kind of where we've gotten away from in our current political environment. So I always think it's always good to look at how we can improve things. We need to be careful and we need to be thoughtful and work together. You know, it's all Americans, as I said, in the code of conduct to solve problems and to improve our society for all. So I'm always open for talking, looking, but I'm very concerned about the politicization of these issues.
Voters consistently list the economy as a top issue. The Biden administration touts low unemployment, strong job numbers for the most part recently, along with other positive economic indicators as signs the country is headed in the right direction. But inflation and higher prices for many everyday goods leave many people still struggling at this point economically. What would you support Congress doing to promote economic growth and improving the economy?
Well, this is part in the beginning of our discussion. You asked some of the sort of advantages that I would bring in the U.S. Senate mm-hmm. that differentiate me from my other candidates. I not only have a medical degree and well versed in the business of healthcare, which is a significant part of our economy, approximately 17%+ of our GDP, but I also have an international executive MBA, which I got at Georgetown, where I did my medical degree as well, and I also have an undergraduate degree in economics. So I'm well versed in not only the economy of the United States, but also international business. Business and the sort of getting to the three pillars that I focus on legislatively, it's the economy, jobs, cost of living is one, healthcare is two, and then education. They're all integrated. So when it comes to the economy, it's complex. It's not just a one and done or a couple different bills we need to do. We need to invest in education, workforce development. We need to introduce tax reform that spurs economic growth, decreases corporate tax burdens, and also incentivizes business development. We also need to modify our tax code that makes it simpler, fairer, and more competitive. Other things we need to do to make us more competitive and a stronger, more robust economy is energy independence. It's also a national security issue, but energy independence, affordable energy is a huge input and cost of doing business. Also, we need to improve government operations and efficiencies, making sure that we're making it easy for businesses to do business, that they're not overregulated, and also making sure that we're fiscally responsible as a government, that we have balanced budgets, and that we quickly start to address our national debt, which I think is one of the biggest issues that we face going forward to keep a strong America.
I do want to move into foreign policy for a little bit. So certainly one of the big issues is the situation in the Middle East with Israel and Gaza. President Biden has been seeking a ceasefire in Gaza to no avail to this point. What should the U.S. approach be in this conflict?
Yeah, well, this is a complex issue. It's been going on for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And the first decision and the way I make decisions, especially as a United States senator, is to do what's in the best interest of the United States. We need to make sure that we have not only homeland security, but a strong national defense. We have a set of values, which is basically founded on our Constitution of liberty, justice, equality for all. So we need to make sure that we abide by our foundational principles and protect those foundational principles. And we also support societies and allies around the world that value those principles. And it comes down to recognizing, our common humanity and being respectful of each other, not only people that live in our country, but also people around the world. So we need to find ways to work together. and solve problems so that we can live in peace together.
Is there a specific role for the U.S. in that Israeli-Gaza conflict beyond, or is it just trying to help broker that kind of ceasefire to begin a process of getting things on a better track than they are right now?
No, I believe that, the United States is that, shining light on top of a hill. We have a unique set of values in the world. We are a very diverse, integrated society, and we are a good example for everybody else around the world how we can live together in peace and harmony. And so I do believe that the United States does have a leadership role, but we can't do it alone. We need to bring people around the world together, and also the people that are in conflict with each other, and we need to bring them to the table and help them work out their problems. Ultimately, they're the ones that need to live together and their neighbors and work living in the same neighborhood.
The other major foreign policy issue on the table is the war in Ukraine. That continues. Where do you stand on continuing support to Ukraine as it seeks to fend off the Russian invasion that is now 2.5 years old?
Yeah, so this gets to whenever you get into a conflict or a problem that you need to solve, you need to know what your objective is. And objectives can change as you learn more about the issue. Mm-hmm. But with respect to Ukraine, most of the information I have is the information that I get through the media, mm-hmm. depending on what media channel you listen to. And I try to listen to many because they're conflicting. That's where I gather my information. Having said that, and knowing even just serving in the state senate at a state level, when you're in a legislative role, you have access to live information and much better information, and you have the ability to find out what the truth is. With respect to what our role is in Ukraine, it gets back to the earlier question, what is our role internationally? And we need to show leadership. We need to we can't do it alone. We need to work, especially with our European allies. And it's about recognizing our common humanity, saving lives, and helping people live in peace and harmony together. So specifically, we need to bring people together and find out the facts, what's going on, but have a goal and objective of what we want to accomplish.
I want to ask a very Senate-specific question because this has been something that's come up over recent years. Should the Senate consider doing away with the filibuster? And if so, why? If not, why not?
Well, that's a question that goes to, how our government was structured, mm-hmm. and there was a role for that. The concern I have, and it gets to the court issue, the issue of whether or not we should modify the court or pack the court, some people say. We need to make sure I don't have a problem evaluating it, figuring out, is it still relevant in today's legislative bodies? We want to make sure there was a role for it in the past to make sure that the voices of the minority are, mm-hmm. are not steamrolled. So I do have concerns about, doing away with it, but I'm always willing to take a look at it. And if I find information that it would make our government work better, then yes. If it's just to continue to increase the power and control of one party, then I would not vote for it. And we've seen some of the problems. I mean, we go back to 2013 with Harry Reid, where he pulled the nuclear option to get some of the appointments in the courts for President Obama. And then, a few years later, we saw what happened when the power in the legislative bodies changed, now people are concerned that, President Trump was able to appoint three Supreme Court judges. And so it's a back and forth. And this is a perfect example of how the two parties are literally ripping our country apart because their core objective is to maintain power and control.
Building on that, this is a time that there seems to be stronger distrust of government and calls for more transparency and accountability. If elected, what role do you feel you could personally play and play in the role as a U.S. senator in delivering greater transparency and accountability and building back some of that trust in government?
Well, I was very active in the state in Delaware in the state Senate with transparency legislation that I introduced, as well as lobby reform and working to eliminate the influence of money and special interests in our government. I would my plan is that within the first 90 days, these are some of the issues I would be addressing. The first thing that I would be introducing is term limits, because I believe that serving in Congress is a duty. It's a form of service, and that many people get elected to Congress and they make a career out of it and build enormous wealth. So term limits would be number one. The second thing I would do to kind of address the efficiency of our government is to do a complete review of government operations, how to restructure our federal government so that it's transparent, it's efficient, lower cost, that we know what our goals and objectives are, the services that we want to provide as a federal government, and making sure that we're able to deliver those services efficiently at lower cost.
What role do you feel rhetoric plays in this issue of distrust in government? I mean, we've heard a lot of talk about, and I think you're even kind of touching on a little bit too about how this politicization is harming our democracy. How much does rhetoric play that role, and is that rhetoric putting democracy at risk because of the way it's polarizing our politics and by virtue of that, the society at large?
Yeah, well, it gets back to America's political system. It's broken. It's grounded on tribal politics, money, and the core value of winning to keep power. And the two major political parties, I really believe, are the root cause of America's divisiveness and dysfunction, not only in the government, but in our society, in our communities. It's this ongoing drumbeat of you know, you're either with us or you're against us. And it's this overall pall of hate, and just the two parties, you know, as I said, want us to hate us so that they can divide us and keep their power. And Americans are just exhausted by it. And that's really the prime reason why I'm running as an independent, because my sole purpose and sole allegiance is to serve in the best interests of all Delawareans and Americans, and abiding by that code of conduct founded on the foundational principles of our Constitution, liberty, justice, and equality for all, and then that behavioral code of conduct, which our current Congress, even at the state level, doesn't have. You know, we need to have a code of conduct, a behavioral code of conduct, in which we are respectful of each other, we recognize our common humanity, we work for and seek unity, and we work together with all Americans to solve problems to improve our society. So I really believe the two parties are the root cause of our dysfunction and divisiveness in our society.
I want to wrap up by asking if there's an issue we haven't discussed that you feel is not getting the attention it deserves in this election cycle, and how you could address it if elected.
Yeah, well, the three pillars of legislation that I mentioned are our economy, jobs, cost of living, healthcare, and education. I've well experienced and have an extensive experience in all of three of these areas, and these areas are all interconnected. So when we need to start looking upstream, especially with education, making sure that we are having healthy babies, healthy pregnancies, making sure that we're providing early childhood education beginning in the first weeks, and that this education is available regardless of the zip code, because a good education, a healthy child, means that ultimately they'll be able to pursue the dreams that they have, their passions, be able to have a job and have economic prosperity. You know, some of the other issues dealing with veterans affairs, making sure that we're addressing the needs of our veterans who've served our country, and also first responders who are overworked, understaffed, and underpaid. They step up to work every single day and put their lives at risk. So we need to address those issues as well.
That's Independent Party of Delaware candidate for U.S. Senate, Dr. Michael Katz. Our full conversation with him is available at DelawarePublic.org. We'll hear from the Democrat in this race, Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester, on The Green this Friday. And up next on this edition of The Green, we continue our series of races to watch with a look at the race for mayor of Wilmington. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. As part of our 2024 election coverage, Delaware Public Media is highlighting a series of races to watch ahead of the September primary. Our series continues with a look at one of the most closely watched races here in primary season, the Democratic primary for mayor of Wilmington. It pits the sitting governor, John Carney, against former state and Wilmington City Treasurer, Velda Jones Potter. Delaware Public Media contributor Paul Kiefer reports, while the race lacks sharp policy divides, it does highlight longstanding tensions about Wilmington's future, including the city's approach to neighborhood redevelopment and the pace of public education improvements.
Carney's entry into Wilmington's Democratic mayoral primary in April was somewhat unorthodox. Governors and former federal lawmakers don't often enter mayoral races, with the notable recent exceptions of former New Jersey Governor Jim McGreevy, who says he plans to run for mayor in Jersey City next year, and current Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass, who, like Carney, previously served in the U.S. House of Representatives. Carney told the Rotary Club of Wilmington last month that he weighed his ability to follow through on his policy priorities as mayor against his ability to do so in a federal office.
I've thought long and hard about what to do next as my term as governor comes to an end. And as I thought about the issues that matter the most, education, public safety, job creation, the answer for me was really very clear. I can make a bigger difference on those issues as mayor than I ever could in Washington, D.C.
Jones Potter offers a similar list of priorities, but she hopes to leverage her experience in both government and the private sector to accomplish them.
Over my career, I've been an engineer and an executive with DuPont. I've been an executive in banking and have strong relationships there. I was former state treasurer and built a number of valuable relationships across this country in that capacity. And I think very importantly, I have experience as a venture capital investing.
Both candidates tout their budget chops, and they draw attention to two key budget challenges in the city's future.
The city's financial structure has evolved and been administered and managed in such a way that fees and fines have become a significant part of the city's budget, so on which the city is reliant.
Jones Potter is referring to a report released by a city task force in March that found revenue from fines and fees, particularly water bills, have grown faster than any other city revenue source in recent years. While Jones Potter and Carney have both publicly expressed concerns about the strain that fines and fees place on low-income residents, neither has outlined a plan to scale back or offer exemptions for utility rates, which largely cover direct service costs. And Carney highlights the growth of Wilmington's unassigned fund balance, which nearly tripled between 2017 and 2024. While that balance, some $95 million as of this year, is technically a surplus, Carney cautioned that the city should tread carefully when considering using that surplus for new projects.
Those surplus funds, which are referred to as the fund balance, have increased significantly during Mayor Persicki's term, mostly because And this we've experienced this at the state as well, is because you have a lot of positions that they haven't been able to fill. And when you don't fill a position, you don't spend money, obviously. And so that unspent money rolls into your fund balance at the end of the year.
Ideally, Carney says the city will eventually be able to fill those vacant positions. Both he and Jones Potter are broadly supportive of current residency requirements for city employees, and especially public safety workers like police officers. To build a more sustainable city budget, both candidates say that Wilmington needs to expand its tax base through strategic investments of public dollars in neighborhood revitalization and infrastructure projects. But in a city with a sharp class divide, neighborhood redevelopment can be a tense subject. Jones Potter argues that some opportunities to create well-paid construction jobs for Wilmington residents, including during the first stage of the riverfront development project, have been wasted.
Local contractors have not had an opportunity for significant roles in the building and construction that's been done. Those are the kind of things that return an investment to the community that we have not seen.
Carney has played a key role in coordinating federal and state funding for Wilmington redevelopment projects, including the ongoing Reach Riverside project, the renovation of the Bancroft School, and vacant home restoration projects in the city's East Side and Lower Hilltop neighborhoods. He adds that the city's vacant housing restoration efforts already employ local minority-owned contractors. But both candidates tread carefully around the subject of population growth, another means to increase Wilmington's property and wage tax revenue.
My focus is on redevelopment and making neighborhoods better and more attractive for current residents. And in doing so, you have attracted affordable buyers to properties that were unoccupied, vacant, or, you know, left to go to ruin by absentee landlords. The focus is on that. It's on redevelopment and community building. It's not so much on what is the natural effect of that, which is more residents in those neighborhoods.
By pursuing mostly renovations or one-to-one replacements of vacant homes, Carney says the city can add new homeowners, and therefore new taxpayers, while relieving the anxieties of current Wilmington homeowners concerned by the impacts of vacant homes on their neighborhoods. Jones Potter is critical of the Wilmington Conservancy Land Trust, a key partner in efforts to acquire and rehabilitate Wilmington's 1,400 vacant homes, which she argues does not always prioritize individual home buyers over nonprofits and other developers. She, too, says that population growth should not be a priority for city leadership.
It's great if we grow in numbers of people in this city, but more important to me is that the people who are already here live a better quality of life. And that can be done by spawning growth in our economy and you know, creating economic opportunity for people.
On some fronts, the primary race serves as a referendum on Carney's contributions to Wilmington during his tenure as governor. Carney cites the Wilmington Learning Collaborative as one of his most meaningful achievements and as a core reason for his decision to run for mayor. But Jones Potter places much of the blame for poor educational outcomes for Wilmington children on the governor and the state's Department of Education. And she questions whether the Wilmington Learning Collaborative is enough to reverse decades of damage.
It's at its fundamental level a go-between between two districts. I am a firm believer, and I believe that given the decline in performance that we've seen over the years, that a Wilmington school district where children are able to learn in their community environment is something that we need to revisit.
Carney says that while the collaborative got off to a slow start, the program is already showing signs of promise.
It does create a city-focused district with full parental engagement and involvement, which is so important. And we did get some very good news with respect to the summer programming they did this year on reading, and that showed some improvement. Usually your summer programming, you hope that the children don't lose ground. And so the fact that they actually picked up some ground is really encouraging.
Jones Potter, whose father worked as a forklift driver at the Port of Wilmington for decades, also takes issue with the delayed start of the Edgemoor Terminal project, which would add significant new capacity to the troubled port and create thousands of additional jobs. After a decade of deliberations on the subject, the state announced this May that it secured funding to move forward with the project. But Jones Potter argues the expansion should already be well underway.
By that not happening, we have lost so many workers that it's just so unfortunate that vision wasn't adopted and by the governor executed years ago.
Carney underscores that the Edgemoor expansion has not been held up for lack of political will from his administration.
And the thing that's delayed it the most, to our great frustration, has been the permitting process. And the reason it's been delayed is because the port operators up the river in Philadelphia see the competition and they don't want it. And they have challenged the Diamond State Port Corporation's application for permits through the Army Corps to slow the project down, and that they have been successful.
He says his close relationship with Delaware's federal delegation could be useful in advocating for the project, though federal lawmakers from Pennsylvania have also waded into the fight on the side of the Port of Philadelphia. But Jones Potter isn't convinced that Carney has been able to substantially address Wilmington's most fundamental challenges during his time as governor, despite his extensive federal connections and the state resources available to him.
So I'm not sure how those things have really helped us as a state, and what couldn't be and wasn't done in 8 years as governor would now be able to happen as mayor. You know, I just believe we have a tremendous opportunity, well, tremendous need, really. And with that, the opportunity to do things very, very differently.
Carney, however, says the days he's spent door knocking across the city have shored up his confidence in his record and his ability to maintain that momentum if he moves from the governor's office to the mayor's office.
I believe, and I believe even stronger now after talking to people on their front porches, that I'm 68 years old now. I've got a lot of juice left to do some good things, and I felt like I could have a bigger impact on the things that I care about and that are important for our city.
The stakes of this race are high, with the winner expected to run unopposed in November to replace current Mayor Mike Brzezicki, who announced last October that he would not seek a third term. Early voting in the primary is already underway. Paul Kiefer, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Paul. A reminder, Races to Watch and other Delaware Public Media election coverage is supported in part by a grant from Delaware Humanities, a state program of the National Endowment for the Humanities. And that's all we have time for on this special edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this show possible, Delaware Public Media contributor Paul Kiefer, our Candidate Conversations producers Ethan Grandin, Jeet Hanslin, and Robert Stice, and Delaware Public Media's senior producer Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us on this special edition of The Green. And we'll see you again this Friday for another edition of The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.